This is Out of Line After Hours with John McElroy and Gary Vasilash, episode 412 for March 9th of 2018, Acadie's amazing engine breakthrough. Watch Out of Line After Hours live at autoline.tv every Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 12 p.m. Pacific. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline in iTunes, Stitcher, or YouTube.
Autoline After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion, and by Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems.
All right, another glorious Autoline After Hours. Mr. Vasilash, good to have you here.
How are you?
I'm doing pretty good.
Good. You know, this week I was out driving the Ram and a brand new Ram. A couple weeks ago on Autoline this week, we had Jim Morrison and Ryan Ngode, the head of Ram brand and the chief interior designer. And I saw those guys this week, and they were very complimentary about the show. But, you know, I really got the sense from them that there's a certain confidence that they have now at Ram. And I thought that was refreshing. It's still, like, they no longer have something that they need to prove.
Yeah. We need to talk about that a little bit later in the show, because I'd like to follow up on that. But first, we got to let everybody know Frank Marcus is back in the studio from Motor Trend Magazine. Great to have you here, as always.
Always happy to be here.
Yeah, and we especially appreciate your technical expertise, because our special guest today is David Johnson, the CEO of Acadie's Power, and we want to talk about this Acadie's engine. So, David, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be here. Really great, and I like to talk about it, so no problem. As you know.
Okay, this is, I think, what, the third or fourth time you've either been on this show or on the TV show. Mm-hmm. When the hell is this damn engine going to be at a spot when I can drive it?
This one?
Yeah.
Or all of them?
Well, any of them.
So, you know, we're in the engine business generically, not just automotive, right? Mm-hmm. So there are applications. This is actually our small engine, the one we're talking about today. But our biggest engine's in production now. So that's with Fairbanks Morris. They make off-road power engines, 5,000 horsepower engines for power generation.
No kidding. I didn't realize. They're in production.
Yeah.
In use.
Production.
What, in mining equipment?
Production and sale, right? So they launched at PowerGen in Las Vegas on December 5th. And they've got an all-new opposed piston engine. Get this. 12 cylinders, 24 pistons, 24 fuel injectors, 2 long crankshafts, making 5,000 horsepower.
What's the peak RPM on that baby?
They run at 900 RPM and 1,000 RPM. So it's 900 for, you know, 60 hertz and 1,000 for 50 hertz. Yeah, power generation.
The tachometer only moves a little bit.
Yeah, so the Navy uses these. They use for backup power, use for power generation, oil, gas, exploration, places where you can't get power.
So they're licensing this from you.
They've licensed technology from us. We signed the agreement back in 2013. So that kind of gives you the idea of the gestation period, right? From getting together and starting a project to when it's available for production and sale.
Okay.
And their production cycle is on the order of a year. So sign up now, and you get an engine for a year from now.
What kind of engine did that replace, and how does its efficiency compare?
So the really cool thing for us about Fairbanks Morris is that they've been making opposed piston engines since the 1930s. Right? So we just collaborated. We had been doing all this technology development to modernize the opposed piston engine. They had an older opposed piston engine, so we modernized it.
Okay.
That's the simple way of saying it. The reality of it is we redesigned the whole engine in collaboration with them. I don't think there's a part on the engine that's the same as it was before. So everything's got a little modification to bring it to a modern state of development. And they're advertising that product as, you know, best in class in the market worldwide.
And the efficiency, was there a percentage you can share?
25% improvement in efficiency. They went from Tier 2 emissions to Tier 4 emissions, and they also improved the power density, so power output of the engine went up too. So a really big change for them, and it's made big waves in the power gen market. So you can get one right now, John, no problem. But the automotive, you know, automotive is a little more challenging with all the transient operation and fit in a vehicle and things like that. And, you know, the companies we're working with, there aren't any automotive opposed piston engines that are in production that we can simply modernize. So we are talking about a transformation. It takes a little longer.
Yeah.
But we're real happy with how the company's developing, how the technology is developing. The results in the test cell are good. So we got a lot of great things to be proud of.
Okay, so you're actually testing the engines that, let everybody know, we've got a Ford F-150 in here with an Acadie's engine.
Good looking truck.
But it's only a demo, right? The engine doesn't really run, does it?
Well, the engine that's in that truck has not run, but it's Kissin' Cousin that's in our test cell in San Diego runs every day.
Okay.
Right? And we built five prototypes, and so we'll have them running on various test stands. And, you know, there's work to be done in the development cycle. You know, the engines aren't just design it and put it into production. There's a lot of development activity that has to be undertaken. And so that's what we're doing now. And, I mean, so far, so good. It's really proven to be a great design. And now we do the development. It's very interesting in development for engines to see, you know, where you start and where you finish and how much you can improve through the development cycle.
Okay, you had this truck with that engine on display at the Detroit Auto Show. Everybody in town must have walked by it. What are they telling you?
Yeah, so 800,000 people went to the show, and I think, you know, 799,000 of them saw the engine in the
Okay,
stand.
But I'm not concerned. I don't care about the public in this case.
Yeah.
I want to know, what about the powertrain people, GM, Ford, Chrysler, Toyota, Nissan, Hyundai, all the people who are in town here.
Yeah, we were a popular stand with those people, too. So we had a lot of traffic from all the right people, and we're excited about, you know, those projects that are already underway. And
when are you going to sign an agreement with one of the major automakers?
Well, so I have this problem, John, that I don't get to talk about such things. I would really like to talk about the agreements I've already signed and tell you about which agreement will be next. And, you know, frankly, it's a little bit of my, I got to keep the secrets of my customers.
Okay. Can you answer this
way?
In 2017 at the North American Auto Show, you said that a company had signed to produce it. Were you then referring to this power generation outfit, or was that a light duty engine that you were talking about?
Yeah, so I can tell you that the customers that we had signed included the one that's now in production, but there are others that are on their way. So, unfortunately, I mean,
you guys said tooling.
Listen,
were they the ones?
I would love to.
Tell us
this. It's killing me. Can you ask me some other question?
Yeah, no. Do you have a potential licensee for an automotive application like you've got the engine in this truck?
Like it, yes.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. So supposedly General Motors is going to make some big announcement about an unconventional kind of engine.
That's good for them.
Okay.
Yeah. Is it good for you?
I'm just reading your body language.
Yeah, no, I mean, I worked at Ford and GM, and basically, you know, these companies, they talk about what is for sale or just about to be for sale. Mm-hmm. So that's their normal business. That's the way they've got a role, and... yeah, so it's, sorry. I know, okay, it's unsatisfying.
Okay, so the engine in this is a 2.7, right?
2.7 liter, three-cylinder.
And so tell us why, say, Ford might be interested in having that engine in the F-150 rather than the 6 or the 8 that they have, or the forthcoming diesel.
So, yeah, glad to. Thank you for the question, Gary. Basically,
because I got you off of John's...
thank you. Appreciate it. So, you know, this engine running on gasoline, as we're developing it right now under our ARPA-E grant, it was a $9 million grant. We got 2 years ago to design and develop this engine on gasoline. This engine on gasoline will deliver 37 miles per gallon.
Combined.
CAFE combined, right?
So huge.
It's a huge number, right? So this is 32% higher than the comparable gasoline engine from the Ford F-150.
And what transmission does that assume?
Okay, so we have, all this assumes that you don't change anything in the vehicle from what you started with, right? Just swap the engine out. So all the things you can do in terms of optimizing the engine, you know, so our engine rejects less heat to coolant, so you can make the radiator small, maybe the aerodynamics gets better. There's a whole bunch of things you can do to optimize the vehicle system, including ours, including you can hybridize it. So there's no hybridization on this. The 48 volt that's on the Rams, not on this truck. So there's a whole bunch of things you can do in addition.
But does that 37 portend the 10 speed, which came in kind of late, so you maybe started with an earlier transmission? And you have told me that you don't need 10 speeds as much with this engine because of the flexibility of the, you know, so forth.
That our fuel map is flat, right? So basically, you change gears to get to a, they call it the sweet spot of the fuel map, right? Well, our sweet spot is bigger, flatter, so we don't need as many gears. I don't recall off the top of my head which transmission we used for the analysis at the time, but it was this vehicle with this transmission, take out the engine, put our engine in, same transmission. So whether it was the 8-speed or 10-speed, I don't recall.
So 37 miles to the gallon, you don't have to hybridize it or anything. What about cost? If I'm an automaker trying to determine how do I hit this 2025 fuel economy standard for trucks. Do I go electric? Do I go mild or strong hybrid? What's your cost like?
Guaranteed to be significantly cheaper than all those things you were just mentioning in terms of electrification, hybridization, or other wild things, right? There is no way to get 32% improvement in fuel efficiency more cost effectively than this. When we do the analysis of the engine system, which, when I say engine system, engine by itself, not so interesting without the after treatment. You know, there's a lot of cost in the after treatment. We've already done and published results showing that we can get 30% of the cost out of the after treatment system. So that's a big move, right? Plus, we got rid of the cylinder head and valve train. Now, we add a few things. We get two cranks instead of one, but they're shorter. So, you know, kind of we do all this stuff. Now, there's a whole bunch of commercial aspects, right? You go off to your BorgWarner or your Honeywell or whoever's going to do your this, that, and the other thing, and you have the negotiation around the price. So what we really look at is, you know, how much mass is there, how many parts are there, you know, significant parts reduction. And so we think the cost is going to be parity or better. Better than the conventional.
And cooling system is a little smaller, too.
Cool. So it's all these little optimizations that can be done. And for the most part, we're not factoring those in. It's really the after treatment and elimination of the valve train.
Okay, so you're talking about fuel efficiency, but if I'm a truck guy, I want torque. You haven't talked about, I mean, so we could have a very small engine in a truck, and you could say, oh, I get 50 miles per gallon, but it'd be like driving a slug.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. That would be an unfair comparison. We don't make any unfair comparisons, right? So when I say 37 miles per gallon, this is same power and torque. And actually, as we designed and developed this engine, we're actually higher in power and torque than all of those 3-liter diesel engines that Ford, GM, and Dodge or Ram are offering, right? They get 2 3-liter V6 and 1 inline 3-liter engine, and our power and torque would beat all three of them.
You mentioned last
year. By a smidge. We're not talking double or anything.
A lot fewer parts, but that's a big engine. It's a tall engine. In fact, Bradley wrote in to ask, why aren't the cylinders horizontal?
So
they're vertical.
So it's a little bit off vertical. It's a little bit off vertical. So basically, what we did here was we architected an opposed piston engine to fit where one shouldn't be. Right? I mean, that vehicle is architected around V engines, has been since 1996. Right? All V engines, V6s and V8s since 1996. The I6 went away, the 4.9 went away in 95. Right? So that's what you're given. And so we architect the engine to fit in that. I guarantee you we can make a better engine still working with a Ford or Toyota or whomever to actually optimize it. In that case, flat's a good idea. Mm-hmm. But flat means you're going to change things in the vehicle, and we wanted one that just dropped in. Yeah. This one drops in. Cool. So basically what we did is you took the inline cylinders, move them over by about 30 degrees. Now you've got basically a 60-degree V6, right? And then we put all the air handling on the other side of the engine. And so it ends up looking like a V engine because it goes into a V hole, right? That's been created by taking out the old engine.
Would it fit if it were flat? I mean, that engine, if you guys had made it flat, or is the engine bay just not configured?
We didn't ever study it. I can tell you the project we're doing with Cummins for the Army, which is a big 1,000-horsepower engine, it's going in flat, and it's replacing a V engine. But, you know, military vehicles are quite different than on-road vehicles. So we do specific package studies around the specific vehicle that we're talking about. So, you know, we meet with an OEM and they go, hey, I got to have that engine. Their first decision is in which vehicle first. And then that's what we do. And so the first step is make something that fits. And frankly, you know, we have this longer dimension from crank to crank that conventional engines don't have. They're shorter in that dimension. But we have the length of the engine, which tends to be shorter than a conventional engine. So it's just a different aspect ratio, which causes some challenge, but as you can see, not an insurmountable challenge, totally solvable. And then doing that, 37 miles per gallon. So that sounds pretty interesting.
Are you at all worried about truckers being, you know, V8, you're going to say a 3-cylinder. Oh, my God. No way. I can only do a 6, but a 3-cylinder.
So I think Ford has completely debunked that with the EcoBoost, right? Their V8 rates are way down. When I was at Ford, you know, we had the 4.2 liter V6. It was like 10% mix. So it was 90% V8s back in the day. I don't know what the rate is now, maybe 25, 30%. EcoBoost doing really well. So I don't think anybody has any problem with it. Now, I got to tell you, everybody says i3 sounds weird. right? No question about it. Who wants that, right? So, but that's an i3 four-stroke, which is not inherently balanced. Our engine is actually balanced as a single cylinder because of the opposed pistons, right? So just one cylinder by itself is balanced. You put three of them together, it's silky smooth.
Yeah, so basically, even though it is a three-cylinder engine, there are still six pistons, correct?
That's right.
Six
injectors. So when you compare our three-cylinder, six pistons, six injectors to a V6. Now, Ford's V6 has 12 injectors, so we actually have six less. But a lot of V6s just have six injectors, so it seems like a fair comparison. And that's where we kind of say, hey, on that piece, piston cost about the same, injector cost about the same.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You guys also had a big announcement this week. The California Air Resources Board is granting $7 million to fit one of your engines into a Class 8 semi, right?
That's right. And I'll give you another little piece of news that goes along with that. We're really excited about this project. We're going to put another demonstrator vehicle on the road, quite at the other end of the spectrum from this one, right, all the way up to Class 8 truck. But we've also got $2 million from the local air districts in California. So places like the South Coast Air District, which includes the L.A. Basin and Riverside and so forth, and the San Joaquin Valley in California, have non-attainment zones for NOx. And so they're really interested in lower NOx. And this project that we're getting kicked off, $7 million from CARB, $2 million from the air districts, $9 million in total of grant funding, we'll produce a truck with our engine in it that has 90% lower NOx than today's federal standard and 15% lower CO2, so 15% better fuel efficiency than the current standard.
Because
the ultra-low NOx standard, as you know, is being achieved with natural gas engines, spark-ignited, you dragged off some performance and you add a whole bunch of cost, and you can get to ultra-low NOx, but it doesn't really deliver what the truckers need.
Yeah. You haven't announced which or are you working with a Class 8 OEM?
We have a great set of partners, and I would love to be in a position to announce that. Okay. But that announcement is a few days away, so watch your news feeds.
Okay. So this is going to be a truck in fleet use by 2020.
That's right. Two of them, actually. We're going to build two.
So, John, in 2020, California?
No. I want to go drive this engine.
Get your CDL. Get your CDL. Let's go.
Yeah.
Up the grapevine.
Frank probably has one.
No.
Hey, also on the truck that we've got here in the studio, you got some interesting stickers on the side of the truck. You've got Delphi Technologies, Argonne National Laboratory, and Aramco. So clearly, I'm guessing, are they sponsors, supporters, funders? Why do you have them associated with your project?
Yeah, it's a great question. Thanks for asking. So I'm really happy about the stickers. The truck's turned out beautiful. We're taking this truck next week to Washington, D.C., to the ARPA-E Energy Innovation Summit. They have this annually to go through all sorts of projects and have discussions around energy and how to get to the next level. So ARPA-E is really the funding source for this project, for the engine, and specifically gasoline compression ignition. So that was an award we got 2 years ago from ARPA-E, and when we applied for that project to ARPA-E, Delphi and Argonne National Labs are our partners. So Delphi is providing the fuel system for this, and I'll give you a new word, cram shaft. So on our upper crankshaft, we have a couple of cam lobes that drive the fuel pumps from Delphi for our fuel system. So it's a crankshaft and a camshaft all in one. They're our partner, doing great work for us. They're a leader in GCI technology. They've been working on it for years under DOE grants and on their own. And so we basically took, it's kind of like Reese's Cups, right? It's the peanut butter and the chocolate and makes it better.
So, what about their Skipfire technology? Looking at that from Delphi?
The tool of technology stuff?
Yeah, right.
Basically, turning off injectors is something we can do. Skipfire is a very interesting technology. It's very exciting for them. We don't have to have the active fuel management, the variable valve timing, turning off that stuff. So there's potential there, but no, I can say we haven't looked at it.
Didn't mean to interrupt you.
No,
talk about Argonne. What are they?
Yes, so Argonne National Labs has these massive computers and great competency in combustion CFD. So I pride myself and our company, Katie's Power, we have that capability too, but they've got a few orders of magnitude too greater than ours in terms of total capacity. So they basically did a lot of the combustion modeling that got us to the GCI combustion that we're now running in the test cell in San Diego. So it's been
I know your piston dome shapes are really kind of intricate. Did that come out of that research from there?
Very close collaboration between my team in San Diego and Delphi and Argonne National Labs, because it's the shape of the combustion chamber, and it's also the shape of the fuel spray and the shape of the airflow in the cylinder. So it's this combination of factors that comes together to make the combustion system work. And really, we couldn't have done it without all three of us together.
Because really, the piston is what makes the swirl or tumble, right? You're drawing the air in so early on, and then it's whatever's happening to it, it's because the pistons are doing it.
So the pistons play an important part. There's no question about it. And we have this great feature of two pistons making one combustion chamber. So they work together to make that happen. We call that the tumble portion. But actually, it's the liner itself that creates the swirl. So when the pistons are out beyond the cylinder ports, it's the shape of the port geometry exactly that creates the swirling motion that then gets converted to tumble right when the pistons come together. So it's quite a dance of the air to bring it all together, but that's
yeah,
really
we've got
important.
A schematic of that running right now.
Yeah, so that's right. So when the pistons are at their long portion of travel out, and you can see the ports open up, it's the ports that create the swirling motion that we're trying to show there with the blue and red lines, the blue being fresh air and the red being exhaust gas.
Is the liner have some pattern machined into it, or is it a straight liner?
Well, it's a pretty straight liner because we want the rings to conform really well. No, but, I mean, but there is a bore hone that's very important. But it's a proprietary bore hone. And, yeah, so we don't end up talking a lot about that. Mm-hmm. Got to buy an engine and tear into it someday
right.
to see.
But that causes
a Sandy Monroe can tell you about it.
No. So tear down specialist. No. So the port geometry creates the swirl.
Okay.
So it's the air rushing into the cylinder, actually pressurized by the supercharger and turbocharger, going through those vanes that creates the swirling motion.
Okay, one last sticker on the car,
yeah.
A Ram car.
Oh,
why
Ramco.
They come on board?
Well, what we found was we kind of bumped into each other over the years, and they did.
And for those who don't know, Aramco is the Arabian oil company.
Saudi Arabian oil company. They make 1 out of 8 barrels of oil. They've got 80 years of reserves. They're the biggest oil company in the world. Great people, but they're in the business also of finding better and cleaner ways to use their oil. So they've got a research center just around the corner from you here, John, up in Novi. And they had set about trying to say, what can we do to improve the internal combustion engine? And they had a list. And one of those things on their list they found was the opposed piston engine. They'd done their own research, their own analysis, said opposed piston engine. And then they said, but there's that company, Acadis Power. So we got together and we walked them through what we've already done and decided that really we had very aligned objectives and very keen interest to do similar types of thing. And yet we had complementary skill sets. So the kind of lab that they have in Michigan, we don't have the kind of capabilities they have with respect to controls and after treatment we didn't have. They've got a chassis dyno we don't have. So there's a really good complementary aspect of the two companies come together. So that's working really well for us. We're really excited about that partnership. Hey. And, you know, there's a knock-on effect, too, that eventually we'll get around to how do we adjust the fuel to make the fuel and the engine optimum together.
Interesting, right? Yeah. Because I know other automakers, GM and Ford, are calling for much higher octane gasoline than what we have right now.
Yeah, so I think that's good for spark ignition, not so interesting for me.
Okay. That's a good position to be in. Hey, Neil from Normal, Illinois, wrote in to remind us that when we had John Jariga on this show a few weeks back, he's the director of powertrain for Hyundai Kia, mm-hmm. very familiar or aware of the Acadis engine, but he had questions about being able to reach NOx levels. And so Neil wrote in to say, ask David Johnson about that concern.
Yeah, it's actually it was very exciting for us. We basically solved this problem for diesel fuel in 2010, and we've been publishing results since then. So the 2010 results were steady state results, but you know, very compelling, where we had the emissions that you need to have on both NOx, PM, hydrocarbons, and CO. No fair to just do one. You got to do all four, right? And better efficiency. So that was kind of a watershed moment for
engine out, or?
That's engine out.
Yeah.
And we all know in the industry, so on an engine out basis, what do you have to
What's
have?
What's that mean, engine out?
Before the after treatment system.
Oh, okay.
Right?
Yeah.
So you can measure that. Some people call it feed gas, right? So it's that level of emissions that's coming out of the engine before it goes to that little chemical factory underneath the we call after treatment, right? So we know what level. We all know in the industry what level we have to get to. For like a heavy-duty truck, it's about 3 grams. For current standards for light-duty vehicles, about 1 gram of NOx. And we've done that, measured that. That's done. We've also done it in transient tests. And then really exciting, actually, part of our announcement and our work on the heavy-duty Class 8 truck that we just announced recently, the CARB funding, is we're actually going to meet this ultra-low NOx standard, which is nearly a full order of magnitude low, or actually a full order of magnitude less, 90% less, mm-hmm. from 0.2 to 0.02. So, yeah, we have a really good system for addressing NOx. We're you know, lean combustion and keep the temperatures down and good results. So we have lots of data. So I'd be glad to go through that with John. No problem.
Yeah.
All right. We had another viewer who sent an email, and This is an interesting point. He said that there was an engine, the Commer TS3 cylinder engine from the 50s. You mentioned Fairbanks Morris has been doing this since the 30s. Why is 2018 a good time, given the fact that there's all this history, yet as you pointed out, there's no single car out there right now that's running with an engine of this type?
I would say there's two key factors. First of all, the engines that Fairbanks Morris had in the 30s and the engines that the Roots-Lister TS3 and the Napier Deltic and the Yonkers Jumel, all these historic opposed piston engines, none of them met emissions, right? And they weren't, I would say, of modern standards, right? So in terms of durability, reliability, quietness, all these things that we expect engines to do today, they didn't do. So that's actually what we've been working on at Katie's Power, is taking these historic engines that had benefits for fuel efficiency fuel efficiency and power density, and making them meet emissions, and delivering even more fuel efficiency and lower emissions. And the reason we're able to do that is we're actually taking all the technologies that have been developed for four-stroke engines, modern turbocharging, modern common rail, high-pressure fuel injection, closed-loop combustion control and feedback algorithms and engine control units that weren't available, all that technology that's been developed on four-stroke engines and applying it to the opposed piston two-stroke engine.
And it's a packaging boon compared to that Cummer, too, which I think had rockers and a single crankshaft underneath, and it was a gigantic, crazy package.
Yeah, someone called it a folded crank, which sounds like a really bad idea, and is, yeah. So one of the things we did when we started the company is we looked at lots of different architectures, and the architecture that we settled on, the ones in this truck, is, I would say, a traditional, we call it a Junkers Jumo, so the German style, with two crankshafts and two pistons, and I saw you had Don Runkel on here. It's not like that at all, so we don't have
two cylinders. He was very complimentary of you guys.
Yeah, no, we get along great, and he's a great guy, but we don't have that architecture, and I would say that architecture, and I think Don mentioned it, was, you know, really problematic for EcoMotors. Yeah. We have a very standard architecture with a ton of innovation, modernization on top of it. And so that was really the thing. And then Gary, I would say the other thing is, you know, today to be relevant in the marketplace, you got to meet emissions and the most stringent standards. So Tier 3, LEV 3, really low levels, and you know, real world emissions are coming. We've got an advantage for that too. And then you've got to have something that you can offer, because just meeting emissions is not a product. It's not something the customer wants to buy. It's a requirement, right? So that's a price of entry. But then you've got to have something that the market wants. And what the market wants right now more than anything else, at least from a regulatory standpoint and depending on where you are in the world, from a customer standpoint, is fuel efficiency. And that's what we offer in spades. So big gains in fuel efficiency.
Speaking of that, Dave Tuttle wrote in to ask, what about using it as a range extender?
Why not? Yeah. One of the things we like very much about this three-cylinder engine and opposed piston engines in general is that they're balanced as a single cylinder. So a three-cylinder 2.7-liter engine for an F-150 like this one can be a 1.8-liter two-cylinder engine for a Taurus or a Escape. And it can be a one-cylinder range extender engine. No problem. Perfectly balanced. And by the way, build that on the same manufacturing line. So huge economies of scale from manufacturing.
And in a two-cylinder front-wheel drive, you could actually turn it around probably and fit it under a lower hood.
We can do all sorts of interesting things. That's right. And I think there's real big opportunities to re-architect and reimagine the vehicle, powertrain, packaging, and really take advantage of this engine. You know, we look at actually Subarus and Porsches that have boxer engines, which is the exact inside out of ours, right? Two cylinder heads, one crankshaft. We've got no cylinder head, two crankshafts, and fits lovely in those vehicles.
So, you know, you mentioned manufacturing. Global automakers have a lot of sunk cost into making conventional internal combustion engines. Mm-hmm. What happens to that investment should they decide to go with your approach?
Significantly reused. So, example, we're doing a project right now for the Army for Cummins. With Cummins for the Army. This is an all-new engine to replace the Cummins V903, which is made in their Seymour, Indiana plant. And they're going to reuse that plant and make the new, you know, Katie's Power Cummins opposed piston engine for the Army in that plant. Mm-hmm. And so they'll reuse a lot of the tools. So listen, cast iron, forged steel, cast aluminum, machining, assembly, wiring harness, sensors, actuators, hot test.
Just what we do today.
Just what we do today. And by the way, not only is it the same basic manufacturing, it's also the same supply base, right? Federal Mogul pistons, right? Borg Warner, Honeywell turbochargers, Delphi fuel injection, right? So we use the same. Oh, by the way, it goes in the same vehicle, goes in, right? Goes in the same vehicle, right? And goes to the pump, fuels the same fuel. Or next generation biofuels or whatever. All that stuff, no problem. Gas or diesel, whatever. Yeah.
Okay. Rapid fire.
Go ahead.
Here now, because I want to get to a lot of people have written in. We're not going to be able to get to them all. But Wooly Person says, why do you need CGI in the blocks for size and durability? He says CGI. I wonder if he means DGI.
Compact graphite iron.
CGI.
Yeah.
So with respect to material selections on our engine, I would say it's not any different than any other engine. So out there in the marketplace, four-stroke engines, you've got gray iron and you've got CG iron blocks. And there's a cost and a weight and a packaging and a castability, and there's reasons. I mean, basically, it has better material properties, but it costs you a little bit. It saves you some weight.
Okay, we got a number of questions on this. I'll say it from George from Sunnyvale. Do the straight-cut gears that connect the crankshafts create loud gear whine?
I would say no. We do have a challenge with respect to the gear train that we've significantly solved, and that is gear rattle, basically. So we have torsionals on the gear trains. Everybody knows about this, and we've done specific work to solve it. That's actually what Akades Power was all about, is taking the unique challenges of opposed piston two-stroke engines and solving them. And then one by one, we've done that. So this engine's packaged with a three-gear gear train, and we've run it in the test cell, and we like what we hear very much.
Tom Lisinski wants to know, how do you lubricate the upper crank and bearings?
Pressure journals, same way you do the lower one.
Dave Arn wants to know, what kind of engine life could you expect out of this?
So engine life are application-specific targets, right? So a military engine needs this life. You know, Fairbanks-Morrison engine needs that life. A Ford Motor Company F-150 engine needs that life. So you design for that. And I would say that's no different than what we designed for on conventional engines, since that's just a part of the engine design process.
Okay, last question I'm going to ask from the viewers, but it brings us back to my first questions at the very top of the show. Tigers Mundo wants to know, so after all the talk, what date will the public see this?
You saw it at the auto show. You saw it. Yeah. So when are you going to see it at your dealer? I know what you want to know, and it's not soon enough, quite frankly. Yeah. Engine
5 years, 10 years. Can you give us a?
It's in the early 2020s. How's that?
Cool.
And how long have you been working on this?
So the company's been around since 2004. We've invented 400 different patents, right? So you got 200 issues, another 200 pending. A lot of work's been done, a lot of problems solved, and we're really excited about this new development with gasoline. It's really changing everything. So it's a really exciting time for us. It's just
yeah, I got to tell happening. You. Look, it's really exciting to have you on the show. This has been a great segment. I hate to wrap this up. It's been that good, but we're going to have to take a break here. We've got other things that we're going to talk about. David Johnson, though, I want you back, but I want to be able to drive the truck the next time we have you back.
Okay.
Okay?
Yep.
It's a deal?
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah.
Even if it's a prototype, I don't care. You know,
it's a prototype. You can see it. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
But, you know, it's a good-looking prototype, so Ford didn't.
Okay.
We look
real good. David Johnson, so
thank
awesome to have you on the show, man.
Thank
it's really
much.
Good. Yeah. We're going to take a quick break right now and give a good shout out to our friends at Bridgestone.
You may have seen them at top-notch trade shows around the country or sat on them in a friend's car. Catskin, the premier manufacturer of custom leather interiors, has teamed up with Autoline to give away a free brand new interior for your vehicle. Go to our website, autoline.tv, to enter. Good luck.
Okay, we're back. Boy, you're the engineer in the studio here, Frank. What do you think about this engine?
You know, I'm fascinated by it. As an engineer, I have always delighted in looking at oddball engines, new different ways. And there's the SAE show has one or two of these turn up every year. Most of them never go anywhere. These guys came in like 14, I think I first wrote about them, from the SAE show. So it's really neat to see this one, you know, getting some altitude and getting some wind under its wings. And the numbers certainly are impressive. And all the science that backs them up all makes sense. So I'm less inclined to go, I'll believe it when I see it.
Yeah. Gary, what's your thoughts?
I think it's interesting that, you know, he made the point that they're taking, you know, a classic engine design that didn't work very well with the technology that was available at the time and optimizing it. It sort of reminds me of the thing, you know, that Da Vinci invented the helicopter, but he couldn't make it because he didn't have the technology in order to make it work. These guys are basically taking something that existed, but using, as you say, Frank, you know, modern technology. So whether it's from Delphi or the computational fluid dynamics that they're having from Argonne Labs, you know, which seems to me that there's a whole lot of potential.
And it'll be great in these things. It'll be really great Because, you know, you can make electric pickup trucks, okay? We could make that work. Over-the-road long-haul trucks, Elon, I just don't see it. I don't see electric doing that job. And so this kind of thing is going to help solve that long-term ultra-low NOx. We need to climb big mountains and go 400 or 500 miles in between fill-ups a lot more reliably, I think, than electric's going to.
What do you think?
No, I love your point, Gary, that, you know, they've taken an old engine, you know, that goes back to the 30s and said, hey, wait a minute, let's put fuel injection, let's put computer controls on it, let's do CFD, let's do all this stuff. And yeah, why not? I think it's very clever of them to go back in history. In fact, I would recommend everybody in the auto industry ought to go spend some time in automotive museums and look at what was done in the past, because I swear to God, if they didn't invent it, they thought of everything by 1908. They just didn't have electronics or plastics or some of the metallurgy that we have today.
But and the computational fluid
they
dynamics.
They thought of that, right, yeah, and that, right. Mm-hmm. So more power to them. I think it'd be brilliant if this thing absolutely comes to fruition, meets all the goals and the like. Because I'm like you, Frank. I'm a little bit skeptical about electrics. I love driving electric cars. I will never call them zero-emission vehicles, though, because the batteries are so energy-intensive to manufacture, and nobody knows how to recycle these things in volume. So I'm not sure, I'm not convinced yet that battery electrics are the environmental solution that they're being promoted as. Something like this could really give them a run for their money.
Okay, but I have a question for both of you guys. Okay, so let's say you are working at the executive level of an OEM, and you are given a choice. You either modernize your internal combustion engine plant or you install a new technology in order to make electric powertrains, and you're betting on the future. Where do you put your money?
Again, it's for the duty cycle. I really, you know, he talked about maybe a two-cylinder going in an Escape or something like that. I'm much more bullish on these big ones. When you're going to try and get down, even with the 65 to 70 square foot footprint, you know, the CAFE requirements for trucks of this sort, you're going to spend a heck of a lot more electrifying to get there or doing something like that than you will this. Again, because retooling the manufacturing and all that is really not a huge deal. It's much easier than a lot of the other things. So I'm pretty bullish on this general idea.
Mm-hmm. What do you think?
Yeah, no, look, if I'm the exec, you know, making this decision, do I spend a bunch of money on all new technology that's unproven in the marketplace, proven in the labs, but, you know, so far the public has voted resoundingly. They don't even want hybrids, much less battery electrics. I would absolutely go with this from a pure business standpoint.
And leave it to the marketing guys to sell a three-cylinder and a truck. Seriously, that is going to be, you know, sticky point.
I agree with what David said, you know, because there was all that question when Ford came out with the V6 EcoBoost. Not only is it, what now, 60, 70% of the mix, they charge $2,000 more for it, and they sell them all day long. I think it all just comes down to power and how it performs. And if you get in that car and it burns rubber and you get incredible fuel economy, the perception will change overnight. Mm-hmm. So that's what I think.
And I do really hope that when you get in it and burn rubber and so forth, you get somewhere near that 37 number. Because, you know, most of what they have actually done so far has been, you know, it's very easy to imagine this stationary power generator doing 25% better than the old stationary. They're both running at, you know, 1,000 RPM or 900 RPM or whatever all the time. That's a real easy case. The transients, you know, because it's the same thing with EcoBoost, right? I mean, they have great EPA numbers, but if you drive them, you can either drive them Eco or Boost, and you,
right.
Most people choose Boost, and you don't get
and
the
you don't
number
get the
on
Eco.
The Eco sticker. Yeah.
That's great.
So hopefully this won't be, you know, subject to quite that same variability, and I have a lot of reason to expect it won't, because so much of it is not, oh, we've just downsized it and we're letting the turbo take over. No, we're not losing all that heat into the water jacket, we don't through the cylinder head and all that kind of thing. So there's so much efficiency built into the thing that doesn't rely. The turbo and the supercharger are not making a lot of boost. Those are there just for scavenging and get the air in there and whatever, but it's not running 25 pounds of boost or anything like that for an engine like this, I don't think. So,
okay, on to the next part of the show, which is time for Dr. Data.
Okay, so This one, easy-ish. Okay, so last week Dustin Walsh got it right off the bat in that one. I'm hoping that you guys will not do this, but okay, so Carmen, could you please bring up the first item? Okay, so this is Detroit mano a mano, where somebody versus somebody. Okay, so we have 1380 and 1388. So what might those two numbers signify? Okay, and I'll give a clue. It has to do with last month's sales.
Oh.
Okay.
They're so too close to be.
It's head to head.
Yeah.
Okay.
Wow.
So something sold.
Detroit mano a mano.
Mm-hmm.
So that's probably two Detroit automakers selling a given model each that are going head to head.
And.
That sold in lousy numbers.
Well, it sold in lousy numbers, but within eight
of each other.
Mm-hmm.
Man,
Frank, you got any guess?
It's probably too high for Bolt EV versus something from somebody else. I don't know.
No, I think that's Bolt EV is. I believe the number was higher than that. Okay. I think.
Okay, it is.
I don't know.
I'll tell you what Bolt TV.
Okay, it's not the Bolt TV.
It's not the Bolt TV.
It is. What was their number? It was like closer to 3,000, wasn't it? Like 2,800 or something?
Bolt. What's the January number? Why do I have the January number? All right. I've got it in here somewhere. Okay. No, Bolt. In February, sold 1424.
Oh, that's all.
So we had 1388. So that's, come on.
It's too low for a Mustang and Camaro. I don't know.
All right.
Yeah,
you guys are not going to. Okay.
Yeah.
Carmen, please bring up the answer.
MKZ.
MKZ versus ATS, which are comparable cars, right? And what a surprising thing that it's so close. You're not surprised?
Well, here's the question. I know that ATS sales were up dramatically. I want to say like on the 40% range, somewhere up there. So that's a huge increase for the ATS. But what was it true for the MKZ?
ATS sales were up 38.1% in February versus February of last year. And the MKC sales.
No, or Z.
MKZ were down 33.5%. So one went way up, one went way down, but they're within 8 units of one another.
Yeah.
So then I started looking at other things. So actually, Cadillac is doing pretty well.
They had a great month last year.
So Escalade was at 1675 and Navigator was at 1063.
Navigator's still rolling out.
Yeah, we haven't built up the stocks there.
Probably. All right, MKC was 1550, and XT5 was 4668.
Yeah, kicked their butts.
So it's interesting what's
CTS
what's going on
was
there.
Down only a little bit. They were down like 3%, and CT6 was up. I think it was single digits, though. But you put it all together. I want to say Cadillac sales were up around 12%.
All right. Cadillac sales were up 14% last month. CT6 was up 5.4%. CTS was down 3%.
So what I wonder, because Cadillac has had, they've had a rough time of it in the American market. China, they're doing fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
But I wonder if last month was the turning point for Cadillac. Has it finally bottomed out? Because I was real impressed to see its passenger sedans sell so well. ATS up so strong. I mean, maybe that's just a one-month aberration. But again, the real point is, has Cadillac turned the corner?
I don't know what the incentive landscape was that month.
Well,
it does seem a little unusual. I mean,
remember,
as you say,
they got rid of their former sales guy, a German.
Uwe Ellinghaus.
Ellinghaus, okay. And now they just hired, I think it's Deborah Walsh.
Deborah Walsh,
She's back. She's been in the industry before. But they changed their advertising, too, so it's a bit more upbeat music-wise and stuff like that. I don't know. Is that enough to move the metal? Don't know.
Frank has no answer. All right.
Nope.
Although I did, you know, so you were mentioning, John, about the public not being interested in electrified vehicles, and I thought this was an interesting thing. We didn't talk very much about February sales, but so the RAV4 hybrid was up 18.7% in February. Okay, and the Prius Prime, okay, the Prius regular hybrid is not doing particularly well. The Prius Prime was up 50.5%.
Is that the plug-in?
The plug-in.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you look at it from that way, that, you know, so A, people want SUVs in terms of hybrid-type vehicles, right? And they want plug-ins. They don't necessarily want the straight hybrid anymore.
Yeah.
So. And that's more of a real plug-in this generation. The last one was pretend plug-in.
Kind
of. But I don't know if you guys saw it. We did a thing on Daily that showed Ram diesel pickups outsold all the electric cars put together, all the battery electrics. So there's 14 models of battery electrics you can buy in the United States right now. And their sales were up, and they were up by double digits.
Not that anyone was steered away from a battery electric into a Ram diesel.
No, but I'm just saying... Yes, electrics are growing, and they're growing by double digits. I want to say they were up 16%. But they sold almost 1,000 fewer, all put together, than the Ram diesel trucks that went out. So I'm just saying that to put it in perspective.
But as soon as the Model 3 comes up to 5,000, you know, production a month, you know, those numbers are going to change.
No, listen, I do believe Tesla will ultimately get there. And I do believe it's really going to drive EV sales far higher than they've ever been before. And speaking of that, they just announced they're going to come out with a cargo version of the Chevy Bolt EV.
Oh, yeah, with the seats taken out and
the cost extra.
Yeah, they'll charge you $350 to not put a seat in a rear seat in the car.
Oh, but John, you know they've got a carpet that area and everything. It's probably some handwork.
Yeah.
You know.
In contrast, what was it with the Hellcat that it comes without the rear seat, but they'll sell you the rear seat for a dollar or something?
Yeah, I mean, that's the way to do it. Hey, look, before we get into another topic, we got to take another quick commercial break because we got to give a shout out to our friends at Lear.
Lear Kinexus offers a parental controls application with geofencing that sends notifications regarding driving behavior and location, including curfew alerts, acceleration alerts, and speed alerts, all delivered to a smartphone application that includes vehicle location, driver notifications, and a report card of driving history, including notifications when predefined geographic boundaries are crossed. For more information, visit Lear.com.
All right, we're back. Talking all things automotive. Hey, by the way, Ben Penna wrote in to say, love your show from Canada. I'm only a third way through watching all the episodes.
Binging us.
That's great. We've always had very strong following in Canada. So thanks for your comments, Ben. Much appreciated. Okay, Gary, what else is on the list?
All right, Edmunds came out with the 2018 loyalty report, and it's got some fascinating information in this thing. And you know, we're talking about cars, and we're talking about SUVs, and we're talking even about trucks. And so, speaking of trucks and SUVs, that for the first time they discovered looking at their data, and so they're basically going back to 2007, and this is through 2017, that they found that for the first time, that SUV owners are more loyal to SUVs than truck owners are loyal to trucks. Now, admittedly, this is only by 1%. Okay, so 75% of SUV owners buy another SUV.
Margin of error.
Apparently they find it significant enough to make the claim that it's now...
So that's not saying that if I have driven a particular SUV, I'm going to go back to that SUV. It's just if I've had an SUV, I'm going to buy another SUV.
Correct.
More than a truck guy's going to buy another truck.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, but then they found that, in terms of passenger cars, so it's 75% SUV owners buy another SUV, 74% of truck owners buy another truck. Of course, you think about it. I'm
sure a few truck guys are buying SUVs now, too.
Although I've got to believe that, what is the percentage of trucks that are sold to people who use them for their jobs, right? I mean, they're not going to...
And it's finally dawned on some of those people that they can rent one for $20 for 75 minutes at Home Depot.
and only 57% of car owners. Now, another thing that was interesting is that in 2017, passenger cars accounted for 36% of all vehicles sold, the lowest market share figure ever.
Yeah. No, so, I'm predicting that at some point this year, we're going to have 70% truck market share in the U.S. market.
Yeah, and so another thing that was sort of interesting is that they looked at people who are trading in vehicles for the same brand. Okay, so if you have a Chevy and you go and you buy another Chevy and so on and so forth. And what I thought was interesting, okay, so we mentioned Cadillac. Okay, so in 2017, 31% of those who came in to a Cadillac dealer got another Cadillac. But back in 2007, it was 43%. So it's actually gone down. Volvo, you'd think that they're getting better, right? 26% in 2017 versus 33% in 2007. Again, it's gone down. Jaguar, which is also, having a resurgence, 24% in 2017 versus 30% in 2007.
The market's more competitive is what those numbers say.
Although Lexus, 51% in 2017, 49% in 2007. And so they led in 2007, and they continue to lead today. And, and then you get into, regular cars. They made the point that Subaru has just, nailed it. They're in second place now. So in 2017, 61% came in and bought another Subaru. Versus 45% back in 2007.
Yeah, no, Subaru, those guys, man, do they know what they're doing.
And so...
In fact, didn't I just see Tom Dahl got CEO finally?
Yeah.
He runs Subaru in the U.S., and he was chief operating officer, and I don't know why they didn't make him CEO years ago.
He was
totally deserved...
Person of the year 2 years ago, I think.
Was it right? Yeah, no, he's really driven the success at that company.
So... John, you made an interesting point. There's more competition. So do you think that going forward, there'll be even more churn as people have less brand loyalty?
Yeah, I do, because, and you've been talking mostly in the luxury end. Now you've got all these EV startups trying to get in. Look at Tesla. Tesla, has clobbered the over $100,000 price segment in the market. We'll see if Faraday and Lucid and the rest of them show up, but now there's Byton, there's a bunch of others, SF. I don't know if they're going to just be a ride-hailing service or the like, but that's the other thing that's going to come in, is ride-hailing, where people just say, I don't even want to own a car anymore, or I want to only ride-hail luxury ones. So, yeah, I think there's going to be less loyalty and a lot more consumers saying, I'm going to go try that one now.
Speaking before we get off this ride-hailing thing, we've been critical over the past several months, let's say, about Uber. And I got to give a shout-out to these guys. This week they announced Uber Health. Now, a problem that a lot of people have is getting to doctor appointments because they don't drive or they're incapable of doing it. And so they've established this new system that basically is not by the individual, but it's by the healthcare provider. So let's say it's by, Beaumont Hospital, and they realize that they have X number of people that are not going to be able to get to their doctor's appointments. And apparently the number is in the millions of people that miss their appointments because they just don't drive. And so what they've done is their Uber is working with these providers, and they're providing the means by which the vehicles can be scheduled to go get the people and bring them to their appointments and back. And they've got this set up because, there are these HIPAA requirements that, you don't necessarily want somebody to know that you're going to the hospital for a procedure or for a service. And so they've got this set up whereby these people, it's not clear to the driver whether you're going to the hospital to visit a sick relative or you're going to the hospital to...
Because you've got the bubonic plague.
Yeah. And so I think that is a very clever thing because, I think that's a big issue that we don't necessarily think about, and it's people getting there, so...
I totally agree with what you're saying there, Gary, and that's what the proponents of all this mobility has said is... as you open up mobility to more segments of society, people are going to use it. You know, and especially once you get to autonomy and start driving the cost of these rides down, even more people are going to want to have a ride in a car someplace.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so to just make it more convenient. And they're even realizing that, you know, that these people may not have smartphones that, you know, that Uber is sort of based on. And they'll send text messages so that people can, you know, even a flip phone will be able to get that. So,
yeah.
Anyway, I thought that was very interesting. So credit to them. They deserve some good news, I think.
Okay, MEC just wrote in to say, I swear Frank Marcus looks and sounds like Sam McMurray.
Okay.
And I ask, who the hell's Sam McMurray?
I don't know.
Relative of Fred McMurray?
Yeah.
Tap your foot.
Speaking of viewers, we got a phone call here. Carmen, let's bring that in.
Hi, John. The invited guests. This is Dale Leonard out of Cleveland, Ohio. This question doesn't apply to the Achates engine, but it's something I would like your and Gary's opinion on. You know, Ford has its Transit Connect, and FCA is using the Fiat version for their ProMaster City. Instead of partnering with Nissan, don't you feel that Chevy should have its own version of the smaller delivery van? Just something I've been wondering about. Great show as always. Take care. Bye-bye.
Yeah, thanks for the call, Dale, and completely agree with you.
Except for the fact if they had Opel, they would have one.
Opel was on its way out the door when all that was going on. So
yeah, an even bigger puzzle to me, and they just solved it, was why Chevrolet was not in the medium-duty market. You know, Ford makes a boatload of money on its trucks in that segment. So does Ram. Well, they finally just announced unveiled their trucks this week. That's probably where their money has been going, is where you can make a lot of money. I'm not sure how much money you can make on one of these little vans, but I would agree. You know, they ought to build something maybe off the Colorado or some other platform. I don't know. What do you guys think?
Well, I mean, think about it. So the Fords, I think they're building the small ones in Spain.
Valencia.
And the ProMaster City comes out of somewhere in Central Europe, I think. So
they all come over with seats and windows. They all get shipped back to go in another one coming over.
Yeah. So I just don't think that, you know, I think when they sold off Opel Vauxhall, they basically
lost the ability to have that.
Yeah, and I think the profit margin is so small that it makes sense to make them over there and bring them over here and the numbers that they're selling in and whatever, and it's hard to make that pencil start up a plant when you don't have anything. A Colorado's way too big to compete with those things, so.
Yeah.
My bigger complaint about the whole thing is the Nissan NV200 and the Chevrolet version of it are the ugliest damn vehicles out on the road. God, I don't know who signed off on the styling of that. They are ugly.
Well, given somebody at Nissan, it's not a Chevrolet, they're...
Yeah, jeez. What else you got, Gary?
All right, so we're sitting here, but many of our colleagues are in Geneva right now. And so there were lots of cars came out this week that none of us will ever be able to afford, except for perhaps you, Frank.
Oh, yeah.
So I think we mentioned it a week or two ago on the show that the Polestar 1, the new performance brand of Volvo, so they announced their performance hybrid 2+2 GT coupe, 600 horsepower and 1,000 newton meters of torque. That's pretty good, right, Frank?
Mm.
And so this is going to... So they, following Tesla, are taking the deposit thing. So they're taking €2,500 will give you a fully refundable deposit.
$2,500? Oh, they're leaving money on the table.
There you go. So they're talking about a subscription model where you'll be able to subscribe for 2 or 3 years, or they'll be able to buy them. Okay. So I thought that was an interesting car, but, you know, it has nothing on the new Bugatti. How do you pronounce it? Chiron?
Chiron, I think.
Okay, so it's a Chiron Sport. And so basically this is a 1,500 horsepower vehicle that is lighter because they have new wheels on it, and so it handles better. And this can be had for a mere $3.26 million. That's including transport, customs duty.
What kind of deposits are they taking on that one?
They're not taking deposits. You got to buy one, Frank. It's got to be. So what else came out that was
Supra?
Is it just me, or am I just getting jaded about all these super high performance, super exotic, way out of the price range of every? It's like I don't care about them anymore. Am I just getting old?
Maybe.
Yeah.
But that's my favorite thing about the Geneva show, and I'm very sad I didn't get to go this year, is you troll around that upper level up there, and there's all these, you know, España, some Spanish supercar made in Barcelona. We never see them or hear them over here, but
they
turn up over there. And I even wrote a column one time. It's a couple of years ago I went there, and they had a couple of fascinating new technologies, nanocarbon in the batteries and so forth. And, you know, so, but there's always
Koenigsegg
brings its latest.
You haven't heard from them for a long time.
Have not heard of nanoflow cell. And that's the other thing. You know, these guys show up. With really good hair and teeth. And to me, it's just an investor scam. Hey, put money in our company, and we're going to build these things and make a bunch of money, and then you never see them again.
Yeah. Well, and that's an interesting technology. I wrote a column on that one, too. Yeah. It's just not going to happen because you refuel it in minutes at a station with fluid, you know.
They never said what that fluid was, though.
Well, you can look it up and whatever. It's
salt water.
Well, it's two sides. It's an anode fluid. You had two of these big tanks. Right. And, of course, when you're done, you end up with something that's not usable. It has to be pumped back out.
Mm-hmm.
You're like, hard to see that infrastructure really catching
up. Not for vehicles. I think for power generation, yeah. There may be.
Actually, you can plug it in and redissociate it back into the tanks. Mm-hmm. That's another option. That takes a really long time. So, yeah, I'm not totally sold on that one.
But Geneva is quite clearly a place where not only they have the Swiss bank accounts, but they have these cars that you need to drain your Swiss bank account in order to buy. And, you know, Detroit, Chicago, New York,
But for regular folks, the Toyota Supra, you know, broke cover in sort of a race car form there. But you could kind of squint the wings and flares off of it and see what that thing's going to look like.
So when do you think that thing will be here as a car that you or I could buy?
Oh, sure.
But not when?
Oh, I don't know. Coming up, though.
Look, if it's racing, it's got to be homologated, right? So that tells me it's going to be in production within a year.
Yeah, it's the longest rollout since the TC by Maserati, you know, which came to about 14 auto shows, too, before that thing came out.
So the Supra is the thing that Toyota's working with BMW on?
Yes.
And what is BMW doing with theirs?
Z4.
Okay.
Yeah, and of course, everyone is saying that Roadster market is shrinking like crazy. You know, SLK isn't being renewed, and so it's interesting to see these two guys kind of coming in with that. But
yeah, it's a halo car, and you know, Akio Toyota. You know,
and there's no,
he's a car
it's
guy.
It's hard to pencil the value of that in conventional terms. So someone makes the decision we need it, and there we go.
Yeah. Do they need it?
I think so.
But as you pointed out on Daily about the sales of Accord versus the Camry.
Stunned.
So Camry, which, you know, it seems to me that is more, and I'm putting this in air quotes, sports oriented in terms of the look.
It's more of a driver's car than
compared to the Camry.
Right.
And so does that play into his success, or do you think it's just all the leases and
going on
fleet
because
sales?
Accord sales are down 21%. Camry sales are up 22%. So Steve Kincaid from Honda, you know, said, hey, look, Camry's got three times the incentives we do. And somebody else pointed out, and they're pumping up fleet sales.
But, and Honda doesn't do any of those.
And they don't.
None.
No, that's right.
And is that pipeline completely saturated?
Well, that's a good point, because Camry has 44 days supply of inventory at dealerships. Accord is 105 days. So that tells me the explanation is not just that Camry has a bunch of incentives and fleet sales going for it. There's something that's causing sales of the Accord to go down. Maybe it's the CRV. Maybe it's the Civic.
But the RAV4 is selling like crazy. The RAV4 is, you know.
No, I think We're going to have to watch how this goes, but I'd say the early signs are not good for the Accord.
Which is really a shame, because you drive those two cars back to back, and there's just really no...
I thought that was very close. For me, it was a hard decision for North American Car of the Year to go. Which do I go with? I went with the Accord. I liked the Accord.
At our Car of the Year testing, everything from the door slam sound to the way it went down the road, we just really preferred
But Gary's got a good point. You know, you guys are all enthusiasts, and the people who buy those cars, by and large, especially those who buy the Camry, I would not classify as enthusiasts.
Yeah, but I mean, they got the safety and reliability nailed. They got the resale value nailed. I mean, Honda is just top shelf, the gold standard on that stuff. And
yeah, although I did see, because I had to look it up, Accord is only top safety pick. Camry is top safety pick plus. From a safety rating, but it all goes down to the headlights.
Okay, but who goes into the dealer and says, are you really top safety pick plus, or are you merely top safety?
I don't know. I would suspect Honda and Toyota buyers are more likely to ask about that than others.
I think old Volvo buyers are more.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, we're getting down to the very end here. We've got one more question here that I think we should get to. And it's probably for you, Frank.
Uh-oh.
Free Happy Bob wants to know, will the 2019 Ford Fusion Sport get the second-gen 2.7-liter EcoBoost engine?
Well, I mean, it probably makes sense. You don't want to keep old engines and new engines out there. But I don't have any direct knowledge on that.
Okay.
So.
Will this be the last Fusion?
Hard. You wouldn't want to bet against that assumption.
No, that's right. Yeah. I mean, Fiesta, Focus, Fusion, what do they get rid of? They got to keep at least one, I would think.
Wouldn't you keep the Focus because it has good European sales?
More of a global car, yeah.
Maybe. I don't know.
Have you driven the EcoSport?
No, I haven't.
No, me neither. Have you?
Speaking of really soft launches, that's like the Envision. You remember that thing? Snuck into the market. No one drove it.
I think, you know, they wanted to do it on the QT because it's coming from China.
Yeah.
They didn't want all these articles from journalists going. Right. But the Ford EcoSport, it just mind-boggling.
It's coming from India.
Well, it's coming from India, but I mean, they were in showrooms with no advertising, no kind of support, none whatsoever. Although the sales weren't that bad. I don't know if you got EcoSport sales. They sold a couple of thousand.
Accidental sales of EcoSport was having to be this high.
No, they sold 2,300 units.
That's not a bad number for something that's getting zero support in the marketplace.
None of us has driven it.
No, right.
See, just goes to show you.
There is one in the L.A. fleet. We're getting one in a couple of weeks.
Look, Henry Payne and the Detroit News just wrote a review on it, so they're out there.
Yeah.
So.
Wow, this is shocking since you just mentioned that, and I just looked at this. 2,300 EcoSports, but only 1921 Flexes.
Yeah.
Speaking of a car that was like never advertised
old.
Yeah, only keep building them.
Still,
people in California love them.
Well, that's right. But
a few people in California love them.
Yeah.
I mean, because if you're selling less than 2,000 in a month,
ancient car.
I think the two oldest cars in the market. I'd love to look it up. I don't have the data to find it though. Is the Dodge Journey and the Ford Flex? They are as old as the hills at this point.
So let's just see how the
look that up.
How the Journey did. So the Journey, 4,782. So nearly more than double the sales of the Flex.
On those babies.
Yeah, I know, but God, if they would only refresh the damn thing, they could sell 10,000 of them.
Of course, their sales were down 52%, but let's not quibble.
Let's not quibble. In fact, let's just wrap the show up. Frank Marcus, thanks so much for coming on.
Always a pleasure.
Always good to have you here.
Yeah,
great show, especially the part with David Johnson from Acadence.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And Gary, always a pleasure to do the shows with
you. Thanks, Sean.
Okay.
Great. Good fun.
And want to thank all of you for having tuned in.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion. And by Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday afternoons. Get your daily fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.